Jean-Paul Sartre explored the most explosive ideas of the 20th century, existentialism, Marxism, Maoism, and directed those ideas to influence how everyday people assess their own lives. His signature works are considered Being and Nothingness and The Critique of Dialectical Reason. He was also a novelist, playwright, and the 1964 winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature, which he declined. Tuesday marks the 100th anniversary of Jean-Paul Sartre's birth. From Paris, Frank Browning has this report.
C'est bientôt la fête des pères. Pensez à vos papas.
You might suppose that the best place to find the spirit of Jean-Paul Sartre would be here, at Place Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir, across the street from the Café de Flore, where he infused dark coffee and wrote much of his major work in the 1940s and early 50s. Cafés in those days were places where public intellectuals worked and debated seriously the major issues of the day. All that's largely gone now. But there is another place where you can find the passion for politics, literature, and ideas that was the Sartrean signature for more than 50 years.
His grave's still in Montparnasse. People come and go on debating, you know.
Annie Cohen-Solal is Sartre's main biographer.
Every day, people put old eggs when they attack him, condoms, use condoms. It's very, very strange. Sartre's grave is still the place where the fight goes on.
Dead now for a quarter century, Sartre more than anyone else embodied the idea that intellectuals must not hide in the academy, but should engage forthrightly and publicly in the conflicts and troubles of their time. It was the end of World War II. He had been imprisoned by the Germans, many of his closest friends and comrades from the resistance murdered. Already a celebrated novelist and playwright, Sartre turned from literature to the social and political activism for which he is now best remembered, most famously in his 1944 address, The Republic of Silence.
Jamais nous n'avons été plus libres que sous l'occupation allemande.
We were never more free than under the German occupation, Sartre began, declaring that it is only in the act of total commitment, when the stakes are nothing less than survival, that we can feel inside ourselves, individually and collectively, the force of freedom.
À cause de tout cela, nous étions libres.
The idea that freedom comes not from being left alone, but from conscious daily commitment, is at the core of both his existential philosophy and his politics, a theme that the American writer Cornel West brought up in a public discussion of Sartre a couple of weeks ago.
He always talked about freedom as something one does with what has been done to one.
Drawing on his wartime experience, confronting a fractured, demoralized Europe cast between Soviet and American superpowers, West went on, Sartre realized that he could not retreat back into the quiet comfort of the literature that had been his life before the war.
Sartre knows that his writings at that moment can make a difference, and it is a sense in which he's looking for a particular cause in which his literary fame can connect him with something bigger than just being part of the pantheon.
Casting aside fiction and theater, he and his life companion Simone de Beauvoir founded what was, for a while, France's most influential public affairs magazine, Modern Times, its title taken from the Charlie Chaplin film. Sartre devoted himself to what biographer Annie Cohen-Solal calls the unheard voices of the world.
And that's one of his incredible strengths and generosity, that the intellectual is the one who stands up and confronts the state.
That meant that he was a relentless critic of the French government. But Sartre also was a constant critic of the country he loved most outside of France, the United States, whose writers, especially Faulkner and Dos Passos, he championed. His first long American visit was in 1945.
He writes something like, they take care of your shoes, they open the doors of the hotels, they see you but you don't see them, they're the blacks. So I think it's from the United States that Sartre really felt for the first time in his life for a racial injustice.
For many Americans, Sartre became the archetypal French anti-American, a view that Cohen-Solal rejects.
His position with the United States is a position of wounded love.
Sartre vehemently opposed the Vietnam War. He organized the famous Citizens Vietnam War Crimes Tribunal in 1967 in Paris. But it was Sartre's empathy with France's outsiders, Cohen-Solal says, that built a bond between her and the philosopher. As an Algerian Jew, she too felt very much the outsider in elite French social life. She was terribly anxious the first time they met.
I had come inside the apartment totally panicked. When I left him, I felt the most empowered person in the whole world. So I owe him a great deal. I mean, he really made me feel strong and powerful in a country where really I felt marginalized totally.
Sartre was, by all accounts, a plainly ugly little man, frail, wall-eyed, half-blind. And yet throughout his life he was surrounded by women. Part of that, Cohen Salal says, was his identification with women as people denied power. Another of his biographers, the American activist and teacher John Gerassi, put it another way.
He would prefer to be with women than with men, he said, because women like to talk about emotions and experiences. And that's what Sartre liked. Sartre didn't like to talk about ideas. Men always like to talk ideas. They always like to say, look how smart I am. And the result is that he was bored.
Sartre wrote his most famous play, Huis Clos, or No Exit, for one of his girlfriends, Olga Kosciuszkiewicz. Its three primary characters are locked forever in a house in hell. Freedom, he tells us, can never exist so long as we subject our actions to the judgment of others. The play was adapted for BBC Radio in 1946.
I just can't bear people to expect anything of me. It immediately makes me want to do the opposite.
Well, why don't you? Why don't you do the opposite? You don't even know what they want you to do.
Oh, it's hateful. Something's going to happen to me through you, too.
Women, says biographer Annie Cohen Salal, gave Sartre his other eye into distant worlds. In New York, there was Dolores, now 94, who was his lover and translator, and who, he said, opened all the doors to America.
The same story happened in each single country. He had Tomiko in Japan, he had Lena in Russia, he had Christina in Brazil. Women were essential to open gates to him. He was very generous with them, buying them an apartment, seeing them once a week and so on. And most of them accepted that contract. Sartre was all together and at the same time the best feminist of the 20th century and the worst macho.
The only way to understand Sartre, the man, the philosopher, or the political activist, says John Gerassi, is through the unity of ideas and emotions. He tells a story about the 1970s when he was working on Sartre's biography, compiling hundreds of hours of taped interviews. Each Sunday, he and his girlfriend Catherine met Sartre for lunch at La Coupole on the Boulevard Montparnasse. Then one Sunday, Gerassi arrived alone.
So he asks me, where's Catherine? And I said, well, we've broken up. And he said, why? What happened? And so I started telling him. And as I told him, I was extremely fond of Catherine, and I began to have tears in my eyes. And he reached across the table, and he said, I envy you. I have never been able to cry for a woman, and I envy you.
As human as his gesture was, it was also classically Sartrean, to act in the moment and give voice and strength to the suffering of another. It was that unyielding empathy for friends, for lovers, and for the oppressed of the world that has always animated the great Sartrean debates, not just at his grave, but throughout the world. For NPR News, I'm Frank Browning in Paris.